accession number 27177, Reel 2.
Tony Swainson, Reel 2.
After HMS Vernon, I went back and did what they call a long course. That's to say, much more physical training at this Royal Naval School of PT. And then I became a qualified physical training officer, a fully qualified one, as opposed to what I did before, which was a short course. And so there I was, fully qualified. When I was at Portsmouth, I was summoned by the commanding officer of the RN School of PT, a chap called Roy Harry, Captain Harry, who said, Swainson, you've got to go and report to the Commander-in-Chief. And I went to see the Commander-in-Chief, and he said, you have now been selected to represent the Royal Navy to carry the colour King George the VI's funeral. He'd just died in February, in January, whatever it was, 52. And so I trained in the drill shed in Portsmouth Barracks, and the old admiral came to see us, and pushed us on our way, and the captain said to me, you realise this is a great honour, Swainson, and of course you will receive an MVO at the end of it. So off we trotted to London. We went to, and I got this huge colour, I don't know what you call it, but it's about 10 feet on a pole. It is the King's colour, and they said to me, you're never to let this out of your sight, and you're to parade with it. And I had a colour guard, that's to say sailors with fixed bayonets all round, looking after me. And a colour guard officer who actually was Bill Threlfall. Now, William Threlfall, probably quite well known as a Wimbledon tennis commentator. Dear old Bill, he was a great chap of mine, and we did the RAF staff course together, so I knew Bill very well. So we got down to Chatham Deep Shelter, which was quite ghastly that evening, and the next morning we had to embus for Paddington Station, where the cortege was arriving. And we got very bored that evening, and so we said, let's go up to town and have a few beers in the local hostelries. And so we jumped on a bus from Clapham, if you please, up to the West End. And we thought we'd go on the upper deck, and I got this thing stuck on that curly stairway that goes to the upper deck, this great pole, which I had to take with me. We arrived around London, and everywhere we went, every pub we went into, with this wretched pole, flagpole, Bill came in and said, ladies and gentlemen, here is the officer carrying the King's colour tomorrow, King George the VI's funeral. And of course, roars of applause and drinks all round. So, shamedly, at about, I don't know, when we were thrown out at midnight, we got back somehow. I can't remember how we got back. It can't have been by bus. We must have hailed a taxi. Got back to Chatham Deep Shelter, only to be shaken at 6 in the morning to embus for Paddington Station, where we all assembled with the flag, and we paraded down the Mall first, and it was very rather exciting because everyone kept pointing to me and saying, that's Prince Philip, look, there goes Prince Philip. I suppose I might have looked vaguely like him in those days as a young lieutenant. Richard Dimbleby, when we were paraded at Paddington Station, came up to me. And we were, the Royal Navy were right of the line, then there was the Army, then the Royal Air Force. And of course, the Army and the Air Force were all wearing great coats, but we were just in our sailor's outfit. And Dimbleby came up, Richard, lovely man, the son of David and Jonathan, came up to me and said, you know, why are the Navy not wearing great coats? And you know, I just laughed it off and said, well, because we're much tougher than these other guys. Anyway, the moment arrived and the cortege was there and we did the salute and I had to do the first drill with the flag. And I saw the new Queen looking absolutely tragic getting into the train and going down to Windsor where he was buried. But it was a memorable occasion and the PS to the whole story, I didn't get the MVO. I got nothing, but I was rather proud of the occasion anyway. But Edward, goes to 1960 or something, Princess Margaret, that was an usher at the wedding.
Oh. Do you want to put that on that? Put it on later.
Yes.
All right.
When I was based at Portsmouth, we used to go up to town for a bit of refreshment from time to time, and I was invited to some dinner and a party that went on a bit. And I was driving back to Portsmouth, and I got onto the Guildford Bypass, And alas, alas, I was in full dress uniform, I think. I fell asleep at the wheel. And blow me down, I woke up on the side of the road. I'd hit an island. The car was completely smashed up. And there I was, totally unharmed. Don't forget the days of no seat belts. Sitting on the side of the road, watching the world go by at about 0400. And blow me down, as luck would have it, along came one of those lovely, lovely police cars, green, were they Rileys? I can't remember what they were made of, what they were, with a big bell in the middle, like a sort of fireman's bell. And they pulled up, and the chap came over and said, "Hello, sir, what's happened? Have you had a tire burst?" And I said, "No, officer, I fell asleep at the wheel." He then looked at me and said, I say, come on, you've had a good old tire burst there, haven't you?" And I said, "No, officer, I fell asleep at the wheel." Well, of course, by this time his patience was exhausted because he was trying to be helpful, as you will obviously understand, and just a tire burst would not have been my fault. But falling asleep at the wheel was obviously an offence. So he decided to book me, and quite rightly so too, because I was so stupid as to not go along with his suggestions. I fell asleep at the wheel. The next thing was I was summoned to Guildford Magistrates Court, where in my uniform I turned up with my solicitor, waiting to be severely punished. Luckily the magistrate was a well-bosomed lady with a large hat, who rather fancied naval officers, I suspect. My solicitor stood up and didn't get anywhere with his argument, and I said to him, "Can I stand up and speak?" So I went into the box, and she beamed at Lieutenant Swainson and said, why did you not just fall asleep and have a little rest on your way instead of driving on?" I then committed the greatest crime of flannel and bullshit, if you like. I said, "In the Navy, ma'am, we are trained, however we feel, however difficult the circumstances, to press on regardless. That's how we keep watch on the bridge." And by then, tears were streaming down her cheeks, and she said, "Case dismissed." And the solicitor said to me after, "I've never heard such a load of codswallop in all my life." But nevertheless, I got off scot-free. And it was because I pulled the line of dog watch, dog tired, standing on the bridge and pressing on. But it all went down frightfully well with that matronly lady from Guildford. My PT course, Captain Roy Harry, who I think I've mentioned before, sent for me one day and said, "Swainson, I'm sending you now as the command physical training officer to the South Atlantic Squadron based on Cape Town, South Africa." Well, Simonstown, actually. It was a peninsula down the bottom. Well, I was thrilled because I'd never been to South Africa, and I'd heard what a wonderful place it is, and I went out there in the Cape Town Castle, I think it was, and the first Sea Lord, I can't remember his name, he was going out too. A lovely man. He was going to the Van Riebeck Festival, which of course is celebrating South Africa's emergence as a nation, I suppose, under Afrikaans rule. And we had a very good trip, 14 days, and then I joined HMS Bermuda, a town, a colony-class cruiser based at Simonstown. And it didn't help when I went on board. You have to go on board in those days, don't forget, with sword and medals, and you call on the captain. And the captain was a lovely man called Captain Philip Curry, who said, "Come in, Swainson." And all he said to me was, "I don't know how I'm going to manage without the chap who you're taking over from." He said he was absolutely marvellous, and he spent about 5 minutes extolling the praises of a chap called Hollis, who I took over from, which I found really rather depressing and rather tactless. And all I said at the end is, "Well, I'll do my best, sir, to live up to his reputation." And that was that. But he turned out to be a lovely captain, and after about 5 or 6 months, he suddenly asked me to come in and have a drink and have a gin, and he just said, "How's everything going?" He'd not said a word to me for 6 months, and I thought, "Oh my God." But he really just expressed that he was quite happy with what I was doing and carry on regardless. The Admiral out there was the Commander-in-Chief of the South Atlantic, which is a great title. But there were only actually a cruiser and three frigates. The commander was the South Atlantic Station, and the frigates used to go down to the Falkland Islands regularly in those days. But the Admiral was Admiral Sir William Paulet. His initials were PBRW. William Paulet. Peveril Barton Ridley Wallop. William Paulet. Now, in this day and age, I don't think anybody goes around with a name like that. But he did, and he was the old empire that we've long since given up. And indeed, to my astonishment, he got sent as governor of Northern Rhodesia, and I think he must have got rid of that country pretty damn quick, because he was a terrible snob and he didn't like the blacks, and that was unbelievable. I mean, considering we were in a black country of Africa, and indeed when we went to Ghana, I think it was Nkrumah, who he just said he wouldn't have on board. He wouldn't go and see. He had to come and see him. And when Nkrumah came on board with all his family, the admiral just ordered to fire off all the main armament. And that they were howling kids and children, and we bumbled them in the boats. And he said, well, that's that lot. And I thought to myself then, well, my God, that's the quickest way of losing the empire that I can think of. However, that was PBRW, William Paulet. We used to do a long East Coast cruise and a long West Coast cruise every year. And we went to some lovely places. We went as far north as Dakar on the West Coast and all those other ghastly places like Freetown and Lagos. And then going east, of course, we went as far east as it was then called Lorenzo Marques. And I think it was when we visited Madagascar that I was chatting up some rather attractive girl, and a French officer came up to me and challenged me to a duel. And I said, what's happening? And he said, you are monopolizing my wife. So I very quickly got a boat and rushed back to the ship before I had to take part in this duel. But the cruises were wonderful. We went to Durban, the Durban Country Club, Port Elizabeth, lovely cricket ground. It was a superb part of the world. And we also had when we went back to Cape Town, we had the entire South African cabinet on board. And there was this first Africana one. And boy, were they anti-British. It was unbelievable. Frigid atmosphere. But we did our best to be kind to them. When we were in Durban, we were just going to have what's known as Admiral's Inspection, where, of course, the Admiral comes on board and with his staff, I might add, and plays up hell with everybody. And we fire off guns, and we have to fry an egg on the forecastle, and we have to lower boats and do all sorts of drills. And it is an annual inspection of great severity. And I was appointed there as the action officer of the watch. In other words, I was the chap on the bridge who really had to control the whole operation from the ship's point of view. So that was a very nerve-wracking thing. But, as God wishes, I got glandular fever, infectious mononucleosis, I think it's called. And I was whisked off to Durban to a very nice hospital with lots of very pretty South African nurses. And the Admiral came to see me there after the inspection and said some rather rude words about how I'd avoided it. But he came to wish me well. It was very pleasant. And I recovered happily. Going around all these places like Durban, Port Elizabeth, all the flesh pots, the captain periodically used to say, right, chaps, we've had enough of this. We are now... And he took us up to what is now Namibia, I think, Wolfish Bay, way up on the west coast, where there was absolutely nothing but sand and desert, and where we exercised for several weeks on end. And that was the idea, was to sort of get the flesh pots out of the system and get us down to be successful sailors once again. Bermuda, which was a very happy ship and a lovely ship, it had about 50 officers and 500 men, I think, was relieved as the flagship by HMS Eurydice. That was a 6-inch gun ship, and it wasn't quite as exciting as Bermuda, and not quite as elegant. And the change of captains, too, wasn't to everybody's liking. I had a captain called Captain George Peters, and one day we arrived in a port, and don't forget, when we arrive, first thing we do actually is spread the quarter-deck awning and get everything ready for a reception for the local expats to wish them well, and they all come pouring on board and drink our gin and have a lovely time. We were somewhat behindhand on the quarterdeck, and so I was the quarterdeck officer. I was in charge of all these sailors doing their stuff and rigging them. See? I grabbed a broom and started sweeping the deck myself, joining in with the boys. And the captain, unfortunately, spotted me and immediately sent for me and said, Sveinsson, go to your cabin. And put down that broom and go immediately to your cabin. And so I went to the cabin and I just sat there thinking, well, that's the end of my career. I should be locked in and all the rest of it. He sent for me and said, what on earth are you doing? And I explained to him that I was helping out because we were shorthanded. And in the end, very reluctantly, I was, I suppose, reprimanded, but nothing else happened. I never really got on with Captain George Peters. I don't think he probably gave me a frightfully good report. But that's life. Don't forget, every 2 years, we in the Royal Navy, we get a confidential report by the captain. And that happens every single 2 years. And so you win some, you lose some, and then you move on. And that's the way it goes in the Navy. When South Africa was all dusted and done, I came back to a shore establishment. I was the command PT officer at HMS Drake, which is the big Plymouth command, home command Plymouth, where I had to look after everybody. And indeed, organise all the physical training and sport for the sailors in the West Country. My admiral was a splendid chap, Sir Alex Madden, very well, a very famous admiral, and he was relieved by Admiral Mark Pisey, another well-known name. My duties were, I was, when I was a duty officer, I had to go and stand on the at Mount Wise, which is the Commander-in-Chief's headquarters, on the lawn there, looking at the over the hammers and taking the salute of every ship that came in and out of harbour, which was great fun. And the Chief of Staff was a chap called Captain Horace Law, who, if he saw a ship's halyard slack or a boat not properly slung or a sailor walking on the upper deck in overalls, immediately he would get me to wing off a signal to the ship, telling them off and telling them, you know, to go out and come in again. It was all very strict and very professional and very nautical. But I enjoyed my time in Plymouth. It was a happy occasion. And, of course, the West Country, the Devonian people, are a delight to be with and work for. And, of course, in the West Country, cricket has always been my first love. I captained the United Services side down there in Plymouth, Mount Wise, for 3 seasons. We played on the lovely Mount Wise ground, which was really a first-class pitch, and it was the nearest I ever came to becoming a professional cricketer. We played first-class sides, such as the Free Foresters and the Incogniti, and I played with first-class cricketers, including Mike Ainsworth, who played for Worcester, Jerry Tordoff of Somerset, and Pom Pom Fellows Smith of South Africa. My boss in Plymouth was Captain J.R. Gower, DSCRN, who was the director of the physical training and sport, where I did all my courses. And he did so much to further my seagoing career in the Navy. And 30 years later, of course, I met David Gower, the England cricket captain. It transpired that Captain Gower was his uncle, who in fact played a prominent part in David's upbringing. David's father died when he was 14, and Captain John was father to the boy until manhood. What a small world. David Gower was born in my hometown, Tunbridge Wells, and what a pity Kent County Cricket Club failed to sign him up. After my comfortable shoreside appointment in the West Country, their lordships decided that it was time Sveinsson went to sea again. I was appointed to HMS Theseus, in Greek mythology, the Athenian hero, son of King Aegeus, who slew the Minotaur. In nautical terms, Theseus was a light fleet carrier of the Colossus class, with a displacement of 18,200 tons. Her design top speed was 25 knots. HMS Theseus and her sister ship, HMS Ocean, formed the Home Fleet Training Squadron, based in Portland. That's where we gave sea training to all our sailors. Each ship carried approximately 500 officers and men under training. All seamen, except boys, passed through the training squadron. The commander of HMS Theseus was a famous submariner, Commander Godfrey Place, Victoria Cross. Shortly after I joined the ship, my sister Peggy died, and Commander Place kindly called up a helicopter and flew me ashore for the funeral when we were in Portsmouth. I never forgot his great kindness, and he was a wonderful man. He had the ex-submarines in when he went over to operating off Norway. It was not long after joining the President Nasser of Egypt secured the Suez Canal and threw the international world into crisis. We were immediately placed on a war footing, and many reservists were called up. This occasioned my first experience of a genuine mutiny. The reservists, at an agreed time, mustered on the flight deck, called away the Liberty boat, embarked their bags and hammocks, and made for the shore. They were all captured by the military police and court-martialed. I was appointed as prisoner's friend to many of them, and their defence was not very strong, and they all did a stretch in Winchester jail as mutineers. A short while after, the flag was transferred to HMS Ocean, the sister ship, and as I was on the flag officer's staff, I was transferred with the Admiral, Sir Guy Sayer. HMS Ocean was the fifth bearing that name. The first HMS Ocean was in 1782, and the one before the carrier was a battleship, which was sunk in the Dardanelles in 1915. It's rather nice about the Navy, they carry on the names of the ships for hundreds and hundreds of years. I was a cable officer in charge of the sharp end of the ship.
Could you just explain what the sharp end of the ship means?
I was the cable officer in the front end of the ship, on the, below the flight deck. There's this great big thing with all the chains and the anchors and the cables, with all the wires, and it's a terrifying place. It was a seamanship task which took my breath away. HMS Ocean's captain was William Beelow, DSC, a wonderful character who lived life in the best naval tradition. He was a cultured man who loved his sailors, booze and women in that order. First night I was duty officer aboard the ship, I reported after rounds, i.e. an inspection of the ship, when we go round and see everything's secure, that everything was correct, and we then go and have to report to the captain. The boats are hoisted, number of sailors in cells, number ashore, etc., etc. A knock on the captain's cabin's door. Come, he's in stride, Svensson, reporting, rounds correct, sir. Bill Beelow immediately said, ah, you're the new boy. Pour yourself out a drink. 5 hours later, I realised I was the duty officer, but I was drunk. When I told my fellow officers the next morning, they all laughed. Never, they said, accept the captain's offer of a drink. Always have an excuse ready. Please, sir, I have to go and hoist a boat or see a defaulter. Anything to get away. I learnt my lesson. Captain Beelow was not only drank like a fish, but he was partial to formalised religion. Each morning we held compulsory family prayers on the hangar deck with the Royal Marine Band in attendance. Every morning at 7 o'clock, the ship's chaplain led the prayers, and I could see old Bill Beelow gently swaying in the breeze after another all-night session. He had the constitution of an ox, a most lovable man. But back to Suez. Both aircraft carriers became helicopter carrier group and allocated the title of Task Group 345.9. The Suez operation was given the code name Musketeer. Ocean embarked the joint experimental helicopter unit known as Jehu, J-E-H-U, a combined army stroke RAF unit consisting of 6 whirlwinds and 6 helicopters. The ships all embarked a large number of personnel and a considerable quantity of stores and transport, including 33-ton trucks apiece. There were assault troops in the shape of 4 or 5 commando Royal Marines to be landed by chopper at Port Said. There was also medical units and sick bay facilities in each ship. They had been considerably increased and operating theatres installed. The task group sailed from Malta on the afternoon of the 3rd of November 1956, proceeded eastward at 17 knots. The time on passage was used to rehearse action stations. The commandos were familiarised with their marshalling stations and the routes to the flight deck. At night, ships were darkened. On the 5th of November, L day minus one, the task group carried out a defensive zigzag to avoid enemy submarines. We were issued with identity discs and anti-flash clothing. I thought then, shades of World War II. And I said to myself, I hope those roses are still smelling sweetly. It was a sad occasion to think, my God, here we are in another war. The American government was opposed to our intention, and the US Sixth Fleet were in front of us all the way, signalling, turn back, turn back. As soon as we reached Egyptian waters and Ebo Daly, the Sixth Fleet veered off and steered a westerly course. When the American Admiral was nearly out of sight, he sent to our Admiral in HMS Ocean a curt signal, good luck. I remember that clearly because I was on the bridge at the time. In other words, up to a certain stage, his political mission was paramount. When he saw that we were ignoring his protestations, his military sympathies were with us. At 0200 on the 6th of November, we went to action stations. 2 hours later, we anchored in a position 8 miles off port side. The cruiser Jamaica and a number of daring class destroyers were bombarding the beaches. When we arrived off port side, the port entrance was a shambles. The canal was blocked, and the dignified statue of the Frenchman de Lesseps had been blown up. De Lesseps began building the canal in 1859, and it took 10 years to complete, destroyed in 24 hours. The French battleship, I should mention, Jean Bart, was anchored near us and was pumping 16-inch shells as fast as she could go into Port Fouad. The French were taking that side. Our commandos embarked in the helicopters, began the assault on the canal at 0600. In the late afternoon, we weighed anchor, sailed into the outer harbour of Portside, and began unloading trucks and stores. We were petrified at the idea we'd gone in so near so soon, and we kept a good lookout for frogmen. Signals were arriving in the ship thick and fast. The Russians threatened to use nuclear weapons. President Eisenhower told our government that unless we withdrew, he would ensure the collapse of sterling. Militarily speaking, the assault was going according to plan. We were within 24 hours reaching the end of the canal at the Red Sea. Nevertheless, Anthony Eden ordered us to cease fire at 23:59. He had to succumb to American and Russian pressure. I don't think the French ever forgave us for pulling out. The canal was put out of action again in 1967, in the war with the Israelis. Many casualties arrived on board, some with serious head wounds requiring immediate attention. So full of wounded, we sailed at full speed on the 8th of November for Cyprus with the 1st Para Brigade, who led the assault from landing craft. The 30 wounded were later landed in Malta. There were two sad incidents on our passage to Malta. A sailor complained to the captain about homosexual advances from a lieutenant commander. I knew him well, a delightful chap, but I had no inclination of his homosexual tendencies. The captain ordered the officer to his cabin and placed one of the young doctors to sit guard or stand guard pending an investigation in Malta. Unfortunately, the doctor left his post for 5 minutes to answer the call of nature. When he got back, the officer had gone. All the officers not on duty were ordered to search the ship. Commander cleared lower deck of all the officers, and we scrambled all over the ship looking for him for about an hour. This we did without success. It was painfully assumed that the officer had rushed to the flight deck and jumped overboard. He left a note to his mother expressing his shame and regret. Tragic and unnecessary loss of life. I'd been talking with the officer the same evening he committed suicide. He was a great chap and a sad loss to the ship. The other mishap was equally unfortunate. A Royal Marine, fully booted and spurred, fell off the stern of the flight deck in a force 8 gale. The captain turned the ship round and searched, but to no avail. Imagine how long it takes to turn an aircraft carrier round onto a reciprocal course. Tragedies of this nature affect all the ship's company. The souls in HMS Ocean are very quiet that night. Right. After more trooping trips, we embarked 4-2 Commando and made our way home to Devonport. We called in at Gibraltar, and the captain and I and half a dozen mates from the wardroom made the trip across to La Linea.